While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the Radio News Analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
A very good afternoon, Namibia, and welcome to On the Reader right here on Eagle FM. I'm your host, Dafa Happy Juju, and it is Monday, the 16th of March, 2026. And it's beginning a new week. Thank you for joining us for another edition of the program, where we take a closer look at the stories shaping Namibia, the region, and the wider global landscape. Now, over the next hour and a half, we'll unpack key developments, making headlines, bringing you news, analysis, and conversations that help place the day's events into context. Now, from economic and business developments to governance, innovation, youth opportunities, and public policy, On the Radio News Analysis continues to explore the issues that influence how Namibians live, how Namibians work, and how Namibians plan for the future. Now, across the country and beyond our borders, decisions are being made and events are unfolding that carry real implications for communities, for industries, and the national economy. Our aim is to move beyond the headlines and provide insight into what does developments mean for Namibia today and in the months ahead. Through our live broadcast and digital platforms, On the Reader keeps you informed with timely updates and informed decisions on politics, business, technology, health, and culture. So wherever you are tuning from this afternoon, whether in Rudret, in Khobabas, in Okanja, in Otapi, Karasburg, Opuo, or right here in Windhoek, the capital city, we appreciate your company. This right here is On the Reader News Analysis on Eagle FM, where information meets insight and where Namibia stays informed. Now let's get right into today's discussions. Namibia has strengthened its efforts to address food insecurity following the signing of new country program framework, also abbreviated as CPF, for 2025 to 2029 between the Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO, and the Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries, Water and Land Reform. Now, the framework aims to support Namibia's national food security programs and strengthen the country's agricultural systems over the next 5 years. Speaking during the signing ceremony, Minister of Agriculture, Fisheries, Water and Land Reform, Inge Zamani Kamwe, said the partnership with FAO is critical in ensuring that Namibia remains resilient in the face of threats and that could undermine food security and livelihoods. And I quote, this collaboration with FAO will ensure that Namibia remains resilient against the threats and could undermine food security and the livelihood of our people, she said. Zamwe Kamwe noted that the partnership will also support the country in strengthening institutional capacity and advancing Namibia's national agri-food transformation energy. Meanwhile, FAO Namibia representative Beatrice Tala highlighted the scale of food insecurity challenges facing the country. According to him, approximately 37.2% of Namibia's population experience moderate or severe food insecurity. Nearly 1 in 5 Namibians is undernourished, and more than 1 in 5 children under the age of 5 is stunted, he said. Tala further pointed out that investment in agriculture remains low. He noted that Namibia's agriculture orientation index currently stands at just 0.26, indicating that public spending on agriculture, an essential component of food security, has been declining for decades. He stressed that the new cooperation framework is therefore crucial in supporting the urgent transformation of Namibia's agricultural sector. The CFP from 2025 to 2029 is expected to guide cooperation between the FAO and the Namibian government in areas such as sustainable agriculture, food systems development, climate resilience and improved livelihoods for rural communities. Let's now take a listen to FAO. Let's take a listen to the Minister of Agriculture and Fisheries. Let's rather take a listen to her first. That is Minister Inge Zamui Kamui.
We are gathered, as you have heard already this morning, to witness the formal signing of the FAO country programming framework between the Ministry of Agriculture, Fishery, Water and Land Reform on behalf of the Government of the Republic of Namibia and the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. This FAO Namibia country programming framework from 2025 to 2029 is the primary framework governing the FAO technical and programmatic cooperation with Namibia over the next 5 years. Namibia continues to enjoy excellent and fruitful cooperation between the Food and Agriculture Organization and the Ministry of Agriculture, Fishery, Water and Land Reform. This partnership has been instrumental in advancing our goals, our collective goals, over the years, as you have heard already from Dr. Tala, in advancing our national priorities in food security, resilience, and agricultural transformation. Together, we have built a foundation of trust and collaboration that is delivering real impact for our farmers and our communities. Through the south-to-south cooperation with China, we are benefiting from the expertise of agricultural specialists who are housed here in the ministry, who are strengthening our capacity in crop production, poultry, and aquaculture. This knowledge transfer is empowering Namibian farmers to become more self-reliant and productive. The FAO-China-Namibia tripartite agreement will come to its conclusion by end of November 2026. And we wish that there will be a third phase of this project to continue the good work that is already being done under this phase two. At the regional level, Namibia is engaged actively in the STOR-SAR2 program funded by the European Union and implemented throughout the SADC region. By enhancing early warning and surveillance system for transboundary plant pests and diseases, we are protecting our agricultural sector and safeguarding livelihoods. This initiative demonstrates the importance of regional solidarity and Namibia's leadership in working with the FAO. This collaboration with FAO ensures that Namibia remains resilient against threats that could undermine food security and the livelihood of our people. We also acknowledge the vital support of the government of Japan through the Drought Resilience Project, which is currently reaching over 6,000 households across Erongo, Kunene, Omaheke, Ochodonjupa, and the Hardap region. By providing agro inputs, livestock support, and climate smart training, this project is helping our communities adapt to climate change and build resilience in the face of recurring droughts. Through this framework, the FAO will be supporting Namibia in building our institutional capacity and coordination architecture for our national agri-food transformation strategy. This is a cornerstone for our long-term vision, ensuring that our policies, institutions, and stakeholders are aligned to drive inclusive and sustainable growth in the agricultural sector. And I'm therefore grateful for the presence of our institutions led by their CEOs and their representative, the Namibia Agronomic Board, the Livestock and Livestock Products Board of Namibia, the AMTA, as well as senior officials from other institutions, because this program is not only being implemented in by the Ministry of Agriculture alone, but the government through the Ministry of Agriculture is coordinating the implementation as a primary counterpart, but there is also active involvement from the Ministry of Environment, Forestry and Tourism, whose representative, I hope they are in the room. If not, maybe they have extended their apologies due to other commitments. The program is also touching the sector of health, and therefore the Ministry of Health and Social Services is also benefiting from the implementation of this program, as well as the National Planning Commission. The current program partners include, as you have heard already, the European Union, the government of Japan, the People's Republic of China, and of course the African Development Bank and the World Bank, as well as a Global Climate Fund and a Global Environmental Facility. These are all partners, as you have heard from Dr. Tala. There is still a funding gap, financing gap, that together with the FAO, we hope to be able to raise the necessary funding that is required for the implementation of our programs. We therefore recognize the role of the private sector, academia, and civil society as essential potential partners in the implementation of this framework. Particularly for the value chain development, we would like to see the University of Namibia, the Namibian University of Science and Technology, all partnering with Namibia and with the Ministry of Agriculture in ensuring that the projects that are highlighted in that framework are supported by evidence-based research that is practical and can be applied by our farmers across the country. As I conclude, Dr. Tala, beyond our bilateral cooperation, Namibia values the FAO role within the United Nations country team. FAO co-leads the Sustainable Development and Green Growth pillar of the United Nations Development Cooperation Framework, and leads the economic recovery pillar. By working alongside other United Nations agencies under delivering as one agenda, which you have also highlighted, FAO ensures that resources are pooled and efforts are coordinated to respond effectively to our development priorities. We deeply appreciate this collaboration, which strengthens coherence, avoids duplication, and maximize the impact of international support. Agriculture remains our top priority and an economic enabler for the current 8th administration. Hence, the programs under the CPF demonstrate the strength of Namibia partnership with the FAO and our international development partners. They are not isolated projects, but interconnected pillars of a broader transformation agenda, one that places the Namibian people, innovation, and inclusivity at the heart of our agricultural development aspiration. We therefore remain grateful and look forward to working with yourself and your team to ensure timely execution of all these projects so that they are impactful for the men and women who are on the ground on a daily basis, toiling with the land to make sure they contribute towards food security and food production in Namibia.
Now let's take a listen to FIO Deputy Country Representative highlighting the scale of food insecurity challenges facing the country. Also, according to him, that is Patrice Tara, according to him, approximately 37.2% of Namibia's population experience moderate or severe food insecurity.
And as it was also said by Patrice here, working as one FAO, FAO is committed to provide that technical support. We are 24 staff in terms of footprint here, but globally and at a sub-regional level and regional level, we are so many, and we have access to all this technical expertise, be it for agriculture, fisheries, forestry, and rural livelihood. And at any point in time, we can bring them here to work with government to strengthen the system. This is just over 35 years of FAO presence here and working closely with government.
Let's pause here for now and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back to continue with this. Stay tuned right here on the Radar News Analysis.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person that does not have a capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past,
mm.
and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. Now, initiatives such as the Country Program Framework, also abbreviated as CPF, signed between the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, and the Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries, Water and Land Reform are significant for any economy because they directly address the foundations of national development, which is being food security, economic stability and sustainable livelihoods. One, it strengthens food security, and that food security is a critical pillar of economic stability. Now, when countries invest in agriculture and food systems, which of late discussions around agriculture have been intensifying, and I believe also their actions are intensifying or should really be intensifying. Now, they ensure that citizens have reliable food security, ensures that citizens have reliable access to nutritious food. Partnerships with international organizations such as the FAO helps government to improve agricultural productivity as well as introduce climate resilient farming practices and strengthen food supply chains. Now, a stable food system reduces the risk of hunger, of malnutrition and food shortages, which can otherwise place significant pressure on public health systems and social welfare programs. So programs such as initiatives such as this helps our communities to come together and play their part instead of focusing their eyes on the government. And of course, initiatives such as this require the government's input or the government's backing for communities to actually thrive at those projects that they engage in. Now, the further also support economic growth as agriculture remains a key economic sector in many developing countries. Initiatives such as this aimed at improving agricultural systems can stimulate economic growth by increasing farm productivity, expanding agro-processing industries, and creating employment opportunities in rural areas. Now, improved agricultural output can also boost exports and reduce reliance on food imports, which strengthens a country's trade balance and overall economic reliance or economic resilience. Of course, I always emphasize to speak on imports over exports, yes, especially when it comes to agriculture exports. I think we can talk about exports when we're talking about uranium, talking about diamonds, talking about basically our minerals, which we have for a long time now established ourselves in exporting them to international markets, or perhaps even nearby markets, other African countries, and especially international markets. Of course, I believe we can talk about exports, and I think at this particular point in time, it is more about exporting not exporting raw materials anymore, but rather to finished goods, you know, adding value addition. But when it comes to agriculture, I always emphasize to say, in terms of agriculture at this particular point in time, there's not really, I think, the time for us to be talking about exports in terms of agriculture sector, but rather reducing imports and rather producing enough for us at home. When we are now sufficiently producing enough at home, then we can talk about exports. We do see we import a lot from South Africa, but also sometimes may give a picture of South Africa is producing quite a lot in terms of agriculture. I mean, if you travel to SA, you see a lot of places where food is being produced, a lot of hectares where food is being produced, enough to cater for South Africans and also to export to other countries. But I believe that maybe at this particular point in time is at the crossroad where we have to really focus on producing enough for ourselves at home in order to reduce imports from South Africa and of course other countries where import food from or agriculture from, and rather strengthen our economy here at home, strengthen the strengthen the communities, and strengthen the farmers, and strengthen also what we are able to produce right here at home in order for us to then be able to talk about exporting this product, this agricultural products to other countries. Therefore, improved agricultural output can also boost exports, yes, and reduce reliance on food imports, which strengthens a country's trade balance and overall economic resilience. Now, thirdly, it can also reduces poverty and inequality. Now, agricultural development programs often focus on supporting smaller older farmers, rural communities, and vulnerable groups by improving access to resources, training, and markets. Thus, initiatives help increase farmers' incomes and economic opportunities. And since rural populations are often among the most economically vulnerable, strengthening the agricultural sector can significantly reduce poverty and inequality. Another pointer, it is building institutional capacity. International cooperation frameworks often include technical assistance, policy support, and capacity building for government institutions. Now, this helps countries improve planning, data systems, and agricultural policies. Stronger institutions are better equipped to design effective development strategies, respond to crises such as drought, and manage natural resources sustainability. As I read there, as I spoke about capacity building, it reminds me of a very hardworking farmer, self-trained. A farmer that is Josiah Shipingana. You know, whenever we talk about agricultural produce, he always comes to my mind. If you're listening, Josiah Shipingana, we do see the work that you're doing in the community, and we do appreciate what you're doing. Especially, I always say it's initiatives such as those when somebody actually stands up and puts in the work. Doesn't wait for a push, but rather gives a push himself, That is something that contributes to the economy, contributes to communities. Why? Because he is self-sustaining himself in terms of agriculture, managing with the little that that he probably has. And also, it serves as an example to young people out there, and also not young people, but people around him in the community. Because when you can produce your own fruits, can produce your own vegetables, it helps because community can come and buy from you. And not only that, you pass on the skills to those around you. So thumbs up to those communities, farmers, and those horticultures who are really doing their part in terms of addressing food security or food insecurity in Namibia. Initiatives such as those also help in enhancing climate resilience. Now, agriculture is highly vulnerable to climate change, including droughts, floods, and changing rainfall patterns. Programs supported by organizations like the FAO helps countries adopt climate-smart agriculture, water management strategies, and sustainable land practices. These measures, therefore, protect food production systems and help communities adapt to environmental challenges. They further promote long-term sustainable development as food systems are closely linked to health, to environmental sustainability, and economic development. Initiatives that promote sustainable agriculture help preserve soil health, protect biodiversity, and enhance and ensure that natural resources remain available for future generations. So let's now take a listen to FAO officer in charge, that is FAO Namibia officer in charge, Fernandine Mwapopi.
And as it was also said by Patricia, in a participatory, inclusive process of government, around the table and putting output that speak to the strategic priority for the next 5 years. So we deliver this technical support through our technical cooperation program. This is a short-lived project to address technical support gaps identified in government to catalyze change, foster capacity development, and help government to mobilize resources to implement projects to address food security, develop the agri-food sector, transform it. And as it was also earlier said by the minister, FAO contributes directly to the economic recovery, transformation, and resilience, as well as sustainable development and green growth pillar, which are, these are also pillars that have been extracted from the NDP 6 as they are, so that FAO can provide tailor-made technical support to help government to achieve those objectives under the NDP 6 and also cutting across other pillars of NDP. FAO works alongside other agencies. For example, with the UNDP, we just mobilized $8.2 million. This is $8.2 million to implement a project on food system transformation, integrating aquaculture and horticulture. This project is about to start. The ministry is now in the process of opening bank accounts so that the funds to be administered by FAO and by UNDP will then be disbursed to that bank account to be managed by government. And this is to give ownership of this project to government to implement aquaculture, horticulture in Karas region, at Nekatal Dam, and unlock other potential for this resource. Aminos, there's a spring there, both Kabongo West and East, and then Omsati along the canal. And with ILO, International Labour Organization, FAO is currently implementing a project on global accelerator on jobs and just transition in the biomass and agri-food sector. We currently supporting at a farm in Grootfontein, Berg Okas, and one of the farms that was given by government, Hemsbok, to develop the biomass sector. Next one. Yeah, now talking about the CPF, I'll be repeating this at the end again. It's just to say that a resource required currently is $15.6 million, of which $6.8 million has been mobilized already from the Global Environment Facility, the Japan government, and also using FAO's own regular program funds. And looking at the $15 million and what we have mobilized so far, I'm anticipating that we will even exceed this resource, provided that we work effectively and in a collaboration with all stakeholders and government. I think this is not too much resource, but it's just an indication. But we should aim to go far in order to really transform the agri-food sector. That leaves a funding gap of $8.9 million. This is what we are going to mobilize through what Patrice has said here, through South-South cooperation. Minister indicated that government is willing to get another third phase of South-South cooperation. We will try to mobilize not only from China, but also too from other developing nations so that we really bring that expertise here and share with our farmers to really improve production and productivity. And also working with other UN agencies through working as one under our United Nations Sustainable Development Cooperation Framework 2025 to 2029. Next. So these are just the alignment in terms of how we are aligned to the strategic national priority as well as the one of the UN system. So how this CPF was developed, as I mentioned earlier, is that Patrice put it, that we are not substituting what government is already doing, but supporting what government is doing. That's why all our priorities is just a copy and paste of from the NDP6, and similarly, that was the case for the UN cooperation framework, making it also easier for the UN system to put our respective technical expertise and really provide tailor support to government. Next. So I will now move to the CPF priority. So priority one, it reads as follows: supporting policies, strategies, plans, implementation, and strengthening institutional arrangement on agriculture, fisheries, forestry, and rural development. And we have here four outputs. When you see the outputs like this, be it Minister of Agriculture, be it AMTA, be it NAB or LLPBN, this is the priority that we identified together. And you should see what gaps do you have, what technical support do you need from FAO. And this has been already agreed. You can ask a request for technical support from FAO. FAO, using its regular program and working with our partners, we mobilize the required support, and this is the work we're supposed to be doing. We're not doing you a favor, but this is what we're supposed to be doing in the country. So the first one, capacity of offices, ministries, agencies, improved for data generation, management, storage and dissemination for agriculture, forestry, fisheries, food security and nutrition. So it talks about the whole FAO mandate. Currently, since this is 2025 to 2029 CPF, we are already implementing some of the activities, including from ongoing activities. In terms of data, we are working with Namibia Statistics Agency, providing technical support. So far, some methodologies have been developed to support the plant census of agriculture. Similarly, we are working with Office of the Prime Minister in the same technical cooperation program to strengthen the capacity of Vulnerability Assessment Analysis and Assessment Committee, NAMVAC, and some activities are foreseen in the coming days. Legislative, regulatory, and policy frameworks reviewed, developed, and capacities strengthened for implementation, monitoring, and evaluation. Then output three, human capacity enhanced to deliver quality extension, advisory and community development services. So we value the extension services of the ministry. And we have been working to strengthen the extension by, example, the Japan project we just launched with the minister, you know, a few days, weeks ago in Ochuarongo. There's also a component on capacity development of which we are also going to strengthen the extension services because this is a modality that we value and it works. We have seen a good result from the field, where the farmers were taught, for example, how to water a tomato, how to water green pepper, how to manage this horticultural product, and to the point that...
Before we actually continue, let's talk about, let's give a background of the FAO and its role. And as you hear also, the Mr. Mwapopi talking about they gave training to farmers on how to water, for example, how to water tomato or how to water a green pepper. Of course, it might sound quite insignificant, but very significant because when you're a first time farmer or perhaps a horticulture in your beginning, you are bound to make a lot of mistakes. I do remember my sister who's particularly studying agriculture when she was given practical work to actually grow spinach. She unfortunately would just plant the spinach and leave it there, only to learn from somebody who had that experience or was a particular student who has experience in the past of growing spinach, that spinach doesn't like cold weather. That's where I also realized spinach is not a winter crop, hence why it requires it to be covered when you do actually plant it, plant it, so that it germinates quite fast, but then it's important how you take care of it. So things like that might sound quite insignificant, but very significant. It's those small steps that actually build up to something bigger. Now, the Food and Agriculture Organization, also known as FAO, of the United Nations, continues to play a vital role in the global fight against hunger, poverty, and food insecurity. It was established in 1945, and the organization works with governments and communities around the world to improve agriculture, nutrition, and sustainable food production. So FAO partnering up with the Ministry of Agriculture, Water and Land Reform is not something that is new. It's something that they normally do, even partnering up with different governments of different nations. Now, one of the main roles of FAO is to help countries develop policies and programs that increase food production and ensure people have access to nutritious food. The organization provides technical support to farmers, as we had Fernando Mwapopi, country coordinator of FAO, also speaking there that they are going to provide technical support to farmers as they are partnering up now with the Ministry of Agriculture, Water and Land Reform. So the organization provides technical support to farmers, promotes sustainable agricultural practices, and collects important data to guide global food policies, which is quite important. It's always very necessary to go back and look at success stories and failed stories so that we can learn from them and also reflect and copy what those that are success stories. Now, FAO also responds to emergencies such as droughts, such as floods and pest outbreaks by supplying seeds, farming tools, and expert advice to affected communities. Several success stories highlight the positive impact of FAO's work. In Brazil, the FAO supported the government's Fome Zero, that is Zero Hunger program, which helped reduce hunger and improve nutrition among millions of vulnerable citizens. Now, the program included school feeding initiatives and social protection measures that ensured families had a reliable access to food. Another major success occurred in East Africa when FAO helped control a devastating desert locust invasion that threatened crops and livestock. Now, by coordinating surveillance and rapid pest control operations in countries such as Kenya, Ethiopia, and Somalia, the organization helped protect millions of farmers' livelihoods and prevented widespread food shortages. FAO has also introduced Farmer Shield Schools, a program that trains farmers directly in their fields on better farming techniques, such as the example that I just made about what Poppy's saying, they help farmers on how to water a tomato or green pepper, for instance. Now, through the initiative, their initiatives, farmers in many developing countries have improved crop yields, have reduced farm harmful pesticide use, and adopted the more sustainable agricultural practices. And also expect say that this effort demonstrate how international cooperation can significantly improve food security and support rural development worldwide. Now, as global challenges such as climate change and population growth continue to affect food systems, FAO's work remains essential in ensuring a hunger-free future. Let's continue to take a listen lastly, what Fernandine Mwapopi had to say.
And as it was also said by Patricia, working as some methodologies have been developed to support the plant census of agriculture. Currently, since this is 2025 to 2029 CPF, we are already implementing some of the activities, including from ongoing activities. In terms of data, we are working with Namibia Statistics Agency, providing technical support. So far, some methodologies have been developed to support the plant census of agriculture. Similarly, we are working with the Office of the Prime Minister in the same technical cooperation program to strengthen the capacity of Vulnerability Assessment Analysis and Assessment Committee, NAMVAC, and some activities are foreseen in the coming days. Legislative, regulatory, and policy frameworks reviewed, developed, and capacities strengthened for implementation, monitoring, and evaluation. Then output 3, human capacities enhanced to deliver quality extension, advisory, and community development services. So we value the extension services of the ministry. And we have been working to strengthen the extension by, example, the Japan project we just launched with the minister weeks ago in Ochuarongo. There's also a component on capacity development, of which we are also going to strengthen the extension services, because this is a modality that we value and it works. We have seen a good result from the field where the farmers were taught, for example, how to water a tomato, how to water green pepper, how to manage this horticultural product, and to the point that production has improved. Now it's to look on the angle of value addition, value chain. It was also highlighted by the minister here. Then final one, effective partnership for technical support, resource mobilization, and...
Phew, what a day. Finally on my way home. And hey, the taxi's empty. So much room. Oh no, why is this big guy getting in and sitting on top of me? No, not the Mimi with the big bag too. Now I'm squeezed.
Sometimes in life, you just get squeezed. But luckily, with Express Credit's term loans, you can get up to 32,000 Namibian dollars to help ease your financial squeeze in under 15 minutes.
Ah, now that's a relief.
Visit expresscredit.com.na. Express Credit, money when you need it.
Partnership for technical support, resource mobilization, and institutional strengthening and facilitated FAO. We are working also as a facilitator to really bring these donors and resource partners to improve our, to transform our agri-food sector. Next one. Now we move to the priority 2, which is economic recovery, transformation, and resilience. This is also copy and paste from NDP 6. Output 2.1. Strengthen the productive capacities of institutions and communities to implement sustainable and diversified value addition in agriculture, fisheries, and forestry. Output 2, technical support provided for improved value chains, food safety, standard international trade policy, and to facilitate market access. Most importantly, we are talking of Africa continental free trade. Just about 2 or 3 weeks ago, we successfully delivered through the STOSA project, STOSA 2 project. capacity development or training on fruit fly management and surveillance control with the grapes and date farmers in the south. It was really good training where we worked together with the ministry. We had the ministry senior staff presenting and really creating awareness with the farmers the importance of management of fruit fly and other pests to protect this industry. And then sustainable agriculture and resilient agri-food system transformation enhanced for better production. But a year and a half ago, we, together with the same ministry, Minister of Agriculture, we finalized the program for conservation agriculture. I hope it will soon be launched, but we are already working on implementing climate smart trainings, example in the Japan project and other project working with extension services. 2.4 improved access to production inputs and markets for smallholder farmers, fisher folk, and value chain actors, especially women and youth. I'm talking more about the Japan project, but it's also one project that makes input available to farmers, agro input through poultry, feed, etc., drip irrigation, etc. But we need a more sustainable way of providing input to the farmers because this project is just 2 years, but the FAO is here to work with government to make that a reality. Next one. Final one, sustainable development and green growth opportunity. Strengthened capacity of institution and vulnerable communities for climate change adaptation, mitigation, resilience, and disaster risk reduction. This is one output that can unlock a lot of funding or resource mobilization through climate windows. We have a Green Climate Fund. We have GEF, and GEF now we is opening the GEF 9 replenishment cycle. And Namibia has an allocation of 16 million from GEF. This is from the STAR allocation, 16 million. And if we don't work together to mobilize that resource which is earmarked for Namibia, then if that fund, then it become unavailable. And next time, if you don't apply, you may not get increased because it shows that maybe you don't need the funds. So it requires that you government also work closely with FAO and other UN agencies to really get this funding from Green Climate Fund, Global Environment Facility and Adaptation Fund. We just submitted another project which has been technically cleared by Adaptation Fund to support semi-nomadic people in Kunene, about $14 million if approved. And it's a collaboration between FAO Namibia and FAO Angola to implement this project. Output 3.2 integrated green entrepreneurial and business opportunities promoted for youth, women, and vulnerable communities through innovation, technologies, and enabling policies. We need to help our farmers to transform, add value, and see local product in our shops. If you go to many of African nations in this sub-region, you'll see really local products in the shops. And it's also my wish, as personally, to see, and while at FAO, I will see how I can also facilitate so that we see local product. This is how we can transform our farmers and move from step one to two. Last one, sustainable management of agriculture, aquaculture, fisheries, and forestry areas enhanced through biodiversity-friendly and climate-smart practices. We are currently implementing another project from 3-4 years ago with GEF funding, and this is on sustainable landscape management, really to do some sustainable land management practice and sustainable forest management. But in future, we should do more in order to contribute to land restoration as while addressing food security and nutrition. Next, yes, here is just to repeat again, a resource required for the 5 years, 15.
There we had it from Fernandine Mwapopi, that is a country representative for FAO, basically speaking about the partnership that they've entered into with the Ministry of Agriculture, Water and Land Reform, that is called the Country Program Framework, to guide the country and to guide FAO also in food security and strengthening food security right here in Namibia. And for now, let's pause right here, take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back with economic indicators. Do stay tuned.
Lipura nengelo wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku tete opoye ekukulile oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe faa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa ninge Pata fanona, Monica ko Eagle FM, onora isatu imwe bali heali, nola natu heali bali no heali. Ileko berewa, nora hetatu natu, bali o hetatu watatu, o mafilane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back, and now for economic indicators before we head to news beyond the borders of Namibia. $1 today is equal to 16.82 Namibian dollars, 16 Namibian dollars and 82 cents. €1 is equal to 19 Namibian dollars, 0.26 cents. And £1 sterling is equal to 22 Namibian dollars and 34 cents. $1 Australian dollar is equal to 11 Namibian dollars and 86 cents. $1 United Arab Emirates dirham is equal to 4 Namibian dollars and 58 cents. $1 Botswana pula is equal to 1 Namibian dollar and 23 cents. Now let's cross over to news beyond the borders of Namibia. Proudly South Africa summit calls on consumers to buy local and to boost economy. I wonder if we have a proudly Namibia, such as South Africa, and where consumers come together and have a conference to talk about, or a summit to talk about productivity and, of course, items of productivity that Namibia can produce, and how we can also call upon our consumers to actually support proudly Namibia. And let's take a listen to Proudly South Africa Summit.
is to grapple with slow economic growth and persistently high unemployment, placing renewed focus on strategies that can stimulate local industries and create jobs. One initiative aimed at driving this is the Proudly South African Buy Local Summit and Expo, which seeks to highlight the importance of supporting locally produced goods and services. The event also aims to encourage government, businesses, and consumers to play their part in strengthening the country's economy through local procurement. It further provides a platform for local manufacturers and small businesses and suppliers to access market opportunities and showcase proudly South African products. For more on that, on what to expect from the summit and why buying local matters, I'm joined now by Happy Makuma Longiti, Chief Marketing Officer at Proudly South African. Good afternoon. Thank you for coming through. This is not the first summit. It's the, you will tell me what edition it is. Why does it remain important for you to undertake the summit over and above the work that you do that is aimed at driving local products and services?
Good afternoon, my brother, and good afternoon to the viewers. Excuse me, you are correct. It's the 14th edition of the Buy Local Summit and Expo. It remains important and it remains imperative that we keep hosting this Buy Local movement every year for the benefit of local businesses who desperately need a platform to be seen, to be heard, to be supported, not because of shame, but because South Africa has got great locally manufactured products that are deserving to be bought, to be supported, you know, for the betterment of our economy as a country.
Yeah. So what has been the learning, what have been the learnings, the key learnings from the previous editions, this being the 14th, in terms of doing it on a more sustainable basis, right? Because it's quite easy to have a day or 2 days of saying, buy local, and we all have that pin that you have.
Yes.
Then we go back to our default setting shortly after that. I imagine that what you want to do is inculcate that thinking throughout the year, but also create pipelines and supply chains that will sustain it beyond the summit.
And it is exactly the reason why Proudly South African pushes this buy local narrative and agenda as a lifestyle. It's not a two-day focus only. After the 2 days of the summit is done, life goes on. Businesses have to operate. Businesses have to generate revenue. People need to be employed. We need to create more jobs, and we need to sustain the jobs that we have. So it ceases to be a government problem. It's a collective responsibility for everybody to play their part in ensuring that when you make your purchasing decisions as a consumer, you do it in favor of local product, because by so doing, you are essentially contributing to creating jobs and start dealing with the unemployment issue in South Africa, one which statistics South Africa doesn't even, you know, it's not even a true reflection of how dire our situation is, let alone the social ills, because when somebody is hungry, they will do anything to try and survive and make a plan for their families. And so the Buy Local narrative and agenda that we push at the Buy Local Summit and Expo, and even beyond that, because we have a responsibility from a domestic mandate perspective to have different touch points, speaking to the private sector, to the public sector, and to consumers as, in, you know, as a whole.
Lastly, then, what do you look forward to at this year's edition? What are some of the key moments and opportunities and innovations that you have introduced that you are excited about?
We're looking forward to walking away with life-changing experiences, real stories of how the summit helps individuals. It's not just a tick box exercise. We're looking for a situation where, just like we come from the last one, where somebody said to us, I was able to open up a factory, move my ginger beer making business from my garage at home to a factory and employ people. Mm-hmm. We're looking for somebody who's saying, through the interventions from Proudly South African, I'm now able to make condiments for retail stores. Those are real real stories that come from the summit and expo. Mm. We have put together a behind the scenes, a business matchmaking program prior to the time where we've matched big business, retail from any industry, furniture, FMCG, you know, clothing, textile, footwear, leather sector industry. And we've matched them up with small businesses with one intention. Come to the expo, have your meetings. And do right by these companies, and, you know, trade with them and buy from them and not just walk the floors yeah. And, you know, and be part of the camaraderie, but do the right thing and invest in the economy right. of this country.
Sounds exciting. We wish you all of the best. I wish I had more time,
thank
but
you.
Unfortunately we have come to the end of the show.
Meanwhile, let's take the listen to another interesting one, the role of technology in agricultural transformation.
That conversation we were meant to bring you yesterday, but because the program was chock-a-block, we had to move it to the globe. Those innovations were on display at the AgriTech Africa 2026, which wrapped up on Friday at the Galaga Convention Center in Johannesburg. The three-day event brought together more than 200 companies from over 30 countries to showcase cutting-edge agricultural technologies and solutions aimed at shaping the future of farming. But beyond the technology on display, the conversations at the expo also highlighted the realities faced by many emerging farmers, particularly young black women, who continue to face barriers such as limited access to land, finance, and markets. Let's unpack all of this. I'm joined by an organizer, Linda Mziwewonga Siboto, and co-founder and director at Chiba Africa, as well as a black female farmer who attended the expo to share her experiences in the industry, Maboang Matlou, founder of Lefakong Farming. Good afternoon to the both of you, and thank you for coming through. Let me start with you. What's the idea behind AgriTech Africa, and how does it fit in with our understandings and concepts of farming in the 21st century?
Well, I think the biggest thing is really around how it aggregates all the stakeholders that are involved in the agricultural value chain. And also it creates like a platform so that at least we're going to see our buyers, our sellers, exporters, importers, and also helping to bring about innovation into the sector. So and sharing that best known knowledge, skills transfer, and then also creating a space of, you know, having these conversations and being able to align with investors and stakeholders.
Yeah.
And that's sort of like the big thing behind it.
So if I stick with you for a moment, Linda, so technology was a big thing.
Yeah.
You know, most of us who are not in the farming space, you think technology in farming, you think harvesters and, you know, crop sprayers right. And the likes. But actually, we're talking high-end, modern technology.
100%. AI, for example. Mm. So with precision farming, they've got special satellites that they utilize. And from that, we're able to determine when's the best time to harvest, when's the best time to plant, when is the issue with your harvest, for example, pests and so on. Also, when is the next water sort of like drought that's going to potentially happen? When is the best time for the actual window for harvesting is going to take place? So those are the kind of tech that we're looking at. And also it looks to reduce the costs of input costs into the actual farming practice, which then helps the farmers to have more profitability in what they're doing.
Yeah. Maboang, let me come to you. Just firstly, tell me about your journey into the farming space.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chulas. I started farming 2015, but I did cash crops. But 2017, I then ventured into the moringa space. So I was totally intrigued by that because it's a niche plant. It's a niche crop, low inputs, high return on investment, right? Moringa is a superfood, which is high demand globally and nationally in our country, right? Because of the nutrients, it's super packed with nutrients. So for me, I was like intrigued to say, let me do this niche product. And the spin-offs are also big. So other than doing your value-added products, which is your tea bags, powders, capsules, etc., with the seeds, you can press oil, which can go into the cosmetic industry. You can do biodiesel with that. You can also do animal feedlot. You can do biostimulants for crops. So I was very interested in that crop. I wanted to change how farming was done and looked at. And my particular interest was in the global markets. So Moringa Low input, high return investment, and easy to scale up. And that would also incorporate other farmers who want to be in the space, right, can be able to feed into our value chain. So we'd then create jobs, and it's also climate smart, and we also speak to nutrition. So that were the three pillars of why I actually ventured into Moringa.
So that is fascinating, because if I stick with you for a moment, the whole idea, you're saying you moved from cash crops into Moringa farming.
Correct.
What challenges did you face? We're talking here about issues around land, finance and markets. In my introduction, I was talking to those as being particularly pronounced for emerging black farmers, black women farmers in particular.
So the challenges are your normal challenges, especially human resource. So I faced a major challenge of human resource. Land was there for me to farm on, but human resource was a major issue. So what I did, I was innovative in my thinking. I partnered with the local municipality where they've got the community work program, right? So I said to them, I've got a project that can actually create a platform for employment for the locals around. Government paid for that. Then I created mentorship program for them. Because what we do at the Fakon, we do farm to packet. So we have the full value chain. So there's a space for everyone to be able to be have a job and, you know, be part of the full value chain.
Yeah. Linda, talk to me about the importance of African farmers, particularly emerging farmers, to have direct exposure to global agricultural innovations.
So with the AgriTech event that we had, so I'm also one of the deputy chairpeople for Gauteng AFASA, which is an African Farm Association. And there we basically require a lot of access to the innovations that are available. So right now we're having foot and mouth disease, for example, within our agricultural sector for, you know, the animals. And so what mitigating, you know, remedies are there available for them to utilize and also to utilize it like immediately, not something that is going to be a talk shop where maybe next year there'll be some innovations. Mm-hmm. This is literally stuff they can take home and utilize when they get back to their farms. And I think the importance for African farmers is that agriculture in itself makes about 65% of all Africans are employed in that. Mm-hmm. And it creates about 32% in the GDP for the country. So being aligned with the innovation and technology of the sector, we can only see it doing bigger and greater things for the country in its entirety.
This says to me then, Linda, that this conversation around the digital divide is actually a real conversation, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's important beyond what we've been able to capture, rural connectivity and access to those technologies as well.
100%. Mm. And I think when we look at agri-processing, which is a real major upliftment process or plan for the country, because now, for example, China now has reduced or has eradicated their tariffs. Mm. So now that's a positive thing for us, but also I would say a negative thing if we're not doing actual finished products. And through technology and innovation, we can then enhance what we're doing.
Yeah.
So Ume here and what she's doing with the moringas, I mean, she's out there wanting to have different sorts of products, the teas, the capsules, yeah. And the gummies, you know, all the things that are coming out.
So let me end it off by asking you, I see that the briefing we are watching is about to begin.
Sure.
Mabuang, how do you harness technology and its power to enhance your systems and give you that edge?
So we actually developed a app with CSIR for our farm. And on that app, it actually helped us improve our plot management, it improved our agro-processing, how we harvested processing, and also very important, it assisted us with profitability, scalability, and sustainability of our projects. Mm. So we are very open to have technology be part of our big journey, because right now we are actually exporting globally, right? So that assists us to be more efficient and have more better quality controls and give quality product out there that actually speaks to what we're doing out here in Africa.
And now for a more educative, informative one, let's talk about understanding heart attacks and warning signs.
Heart attack remains one of the leading medical emergencies worldwide. But what exactly is a heart attack and what are the warning signs to look out for? A medical expert gives us more.
A heart attack occurs when blood flow to the heart muscle is suddenly blocked, preventing it from receiving the oxygen it needs to function properly. When this happens, Parts of the heart muscle may begin to suffer damage if medical attention is not sought quickly. In this case, timely interventions are as critical as every heartbeat.
Heart attack is the first cause of death in the world nowadays. Patients have some chest pain, and the main reason of the heart attack is severe blockage in the coronary artery disease. So this blockage can damage the heart, and the patient can complicate it to life-threatening arrhythmia or cardiac death. So if the patient has recurrent chest pain and with exercise, sometimes we are ignoring the chest pain, moving, we have some discomfort, and then we ignore, no, it is like I received heart attack patient, just have, I don't know, I have spine problem, and he had heart attack for 2 days. So chest pain is the most important sign, especially if it's coming with exercise or making walking or making some effort. So he can must look for it. He has maybe a blockage, so he can treat the blockage early. But if he ignoring and the blockage become severe one and the vessel already going to be abrupt closure, he will develop heart attack and it will be dangerous for him. He will lose his cardiac muscle, even he can die with cardiac arrest.
While many people often associate heart attacks with severe chest pain, medical experts say the symptoms can sometimes appear in different ways. These may include discomfort in the chest, pain spreading to the arm, neck or jaw, shortness of breath, nausea, or unusual fatigue. Understanding who may be more vulnerable to a heart attack is also an important part of prevention.
So there is high risk population, especially the people with high cholesterol or smoking or hypertensive and diabetes. So the main risk factor like hypertension, diabetes, smoking and high cholesterol. Especially we have also high-risk populations. So we are talking now in Zambia. So we have Indian and whites and Zambian. Mostly Indian and whites high-risk more than Zambian because of, I don't know about the culture, the lifestyle of eating, food. So I think Zambian also less heart attack. They started because we have now fried food in the country and the people start eating fried food. But is less, still less. The most common disease in Zambia is hypertension, not ischemic heart disease or heart attack. We are receiving patients now from Zambia, but there is high risk population like Indian and whites more. So we'll find Egyptian like me, oh, high risk. Okay, and even you can find Indian with no diabetic or hypertensive and coming with young age also with heart attack. So there is high risk populations, also risk factor. Also, we mentioned the major risk factor like hypertension, diabetes, and smoking, and high cholesterol. Also, we can mention about the people don't do exercise. Some people is not doing exercise. So, and obese people. Also, this is high risk for having high early atherosclerosis process. Atherosclerosis process means that the vessel start suffering and narrowing, then become severe, then we can do.
Health professionals explain that several risk factors can increase a person's chances of experiencing a heart attack. These include high blood pressure, smoking, unhealthy eating habits, lack of physical activity, and a family history of heart disease. There have also been growing concerns globally about lifestyle-related illnesses, with some experts noting that heart-related conditions are increasingly being seen among younger individuals.
Some young population is smoking too much, and the people with drugs and cocaine and this type of things, the bad things can develop early heart attack. Yes, I received patients with early heart attack. I did intervention for the patient, 29. But this 29, he's high-risk population from Indian community, plus he's smoking. So high-risk populations and also additional of risk factor, so he can develop even in early age. I received in my country 25 and 26 heart attacks. So it's there that we were doing bad habits like this, like some drugs or heavy smoking, yes, can develop early heart attack.
Meanwhile, 107 bodies have been recovered following the Ethiopia landslide.
A traditional mourning ceremony was held today for the victims of the landslides in Gamo Zone. For many families, this was meant as a final goodbye. But for others still searching for their loved ones beneath the mud, it is not over.
5 members of my family, including my elder brother, were hit by the landslide. So far, we have only been able to recover the body of one child. We are still searching for the others, but we have not been able to find them.
Local officials say 125 people were buried by 2 rounds of landslides on Tuesday night, and more than 11,000 people have been displaced. The remoteness and rugged terrain of the area means most of the search and rescue efforts are being carried out by local residents using little more than handheld tools.
We were able to recover many bodies with the help of people from neighboring villages who were still digging through the thick mud, searching for those buried by the landslide. Sadly, there are many bodies that we haven't found yet.
During his visit on Saturday afternoon, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed emphasized the need for long-term studies and preventive measures to reduce the risk of future disasters in the region. Nearly a year ago, a landslide in nearby Gofa Zone killed more than 250 people. As the 3 days of national mourning come to an end on Monday, humanitarian assistance is trickling in from across the country to support the affected communities. Beka Atoma, CGTN, Addis Ababa.
Africa asserts influence on global AI panel.
I am the principal investigator on the research group called Data Science for Social Impact, where most of the work, about 90% of it now, looks at natural language processing and African languages or African languages and AI. Africa has 2,000 to 3,000 languages. Working on more natural language processing, where you're getting machines to process language, started noticing that there were not as many tools, or if any, for our local languages. And that became a very big part of then how do we actually solve for some of these languages. One of the things suggested to the UN was to set up an independent scientific panel to now provide, you know, evidence-based, scientific-based advice to the UN and the member nations to help them navigating this technology and the impacts that it will have. It ends up being that there were 2,600 plus applications, and then the 40 members then were chosen. And yeah, as of last month, I've joined the independent scientific panel. I am very happy that I'm part, it's not one African, but a number of Africans that are on this panel, and maybe even more happier that it's also part of a ecosystem that has been building over the last decade or so. Artificial intelligence is just like any technology, it's a tool. It can be used for good and for bad. The last decade was just this a huge acceleration enabled by computing power becoming much more stronger, more data, and then I think the rise of the big internet companies are really driving a lot of development also in those spaces. It is rearranging a lot of the ways that world economies are working, and some of that is going to have impacts on labor. We then need to then be thinking how our own policies now really reflecting what the expectations of our citizens are towards these technologies. When it comes to safety and data governance, we have an AI white paper from the African Union, and we also have the AI policies that were shaped just after in 2023. You needed data governance and privacy issues to be taken care of, as now more and more you have these systems that are automated, that are processing data. That data might a lot of it is private. Another big indicator is the amount of money invested in R&D in the country. A lot of it comes from government, probably the majority. We are spending about 0.67%, I think, of GDP on research. We don't yet meet the African Union's benchmark of 1%. No African country does. If you then compare this to the US, which is at about 3.something% of their GDPs used to, towards R&D, you then understand why we tend to look towards North America for technology. And then we buy the technology. That then makes it that we are not really going to represent ourselves as well, and maybe some of our most wicked problems we won't be able to resolve. We have to have that belief that we can build these things and then through that shape it for the markets that are around across the continent. Or how do you shape it in such a way that, yes, for some child who might be in a rural area in South Africa, that it reaches them in the way that it makes sense for them.
Drone attack near Dubai airport halts flights briefly.
Authorities in Dubai say a drone incident near the international airport has damaged a fuel tank on site. The Dubai government media office says a fire broke out following the incident, but has since been brought under control by civil defense teams. Officials say no injuries have been reported so far. Dubai's civil aviation authority temporarily suspended flights at Dubai International as a precautionary measure to ensure the safety of passengers and staff. Now, Zain Bouswabi is monitoring developments live for us here in Doha. So we had that attack, but there have been more attacks overnight.
That is correct. Well, just in the last few minutes, the Crisis Management Authority of the UAE announced that air defenses are now dealing with a missile threat and urged people to remain safe in place and follow warnings and updates from official websites. So that was just at 7:51 a.m. on their X account on social media. And this comes after these early morning attacks on Dubai International Airport. As you said, a temporary suspension of flights after a fire on a fuel tank that was sparked by a drone impact. It wasn't one that was intercepted. What we understand from the official Dubai authorities is that it was when a drone made impact and sparked a fire on a fuel tank. Flights have been diverted. The airport has been closed. We have to remind people that this is the busiest international airport by commercial air traffic and air travel in the world. So disruptions to already limited flight schedules at this airport will have knock-on effects throughout the day, likely again throughout the week. And again, it was another busy morning. Qatar and Kuwait taking down multiple drone attacks in the last 24 hours. Bahrain this morning woke up to air raid sirens, and Saudi Arabia reporting that it intercepted 23 drones in the east of the country in three separate waves. That was after, in the early morning hours, between 3 and 4 a.m., they reported intercepting 37 drones. That was in the early hours of this morning. But as we step into week three of this war, in Iran's retaliation for coming under attack, it is clear that the UAE is bearing the brunt of Iran's retaliation around the region against its neighbors in the GCC.
Zain Bouswabi there, live for us from Doha.
Meanwhile, Trump warns NATO over securing the Strait of Hormuz.
We continue our coverage today of the war with Iran as Donald Trump issues a stark warning to some of America's allies, demanding they help secure a critical shipping lane as his war against Iran continues to rattle the world economy. The American president has warned NATO that the military alliance faces what he called a very bad future if its members fail to help open the Strait of Hormuz. Meanwhile, the international airport in Dubai has resumed limited operations after an Iranian drone struck nearby. Saudi Arabia says it's intercepted more than 60 drones as Iran continues to target Gulf countries. Israel says its army has begun what it calls targeted ground operations against Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. The IDF has also announced in the last few minutes a wide-scale wave of strikes on Tehran and other Iranian cities, including Shiraz. Well, Japan has become the first G7 country to start releasing oil reserves to ease the pressure on fuel prices. Well, let's start our coverage now with this report from Lauren Moss.
More than 2 weeks into this war, still no sign of when it'll end. The questions continue about how long it'll last and its impact. On a flight back to Washington in the early hours, President Trump says the U.S. has now asked other countries for help reopening the vital shipping lane in which about a fifth of the world's oil passes.
We're always there for NATO. We're helping them with Ukraine. And many instruments got an ocean in between us. Doesn't affect us. We've helped them. It'd be interesting to see what country wouldn't help us with a very small endeavor, which is just keeping the Strait open, and by comparison.
Sir Keir Starmer had a call with the US president last night about the Strait of Hormuz to end what Downing Street has described as the disruption to global shipping. A number of ships are reported to have been attacked since the conflict began, and there are concerns that Iran has placed mines in the depths of the water. The narrow strait has been effectively closed for more than a fortnight. Meanwhile, this weekend, the bombardment across the Middle East continued. Flames engulfed the main research center of Iran's space agency. Buildings became shells. In Israel, the night skies once again were lit up with rockets fired on them, and shrapnel fell from above. Yesterday, President Trump said Iran wanted to negotiate, something the regime has dismissed.
It's not a war of survival. We are you know, stable and strong enough. We are only defending our people from this act of aggression, and we don't see any reason why we should talk with Americans, because we were talking with them when they decided to attack us, and that was for the second time.
This morning, flights at Dubai Airport have been temporarily suspended after a fire caused by a drone attack. No one is believed to have been injured. The UK government has announced £5 million in emergency funding for humanitarian relief in Lebanon. The health ministry there says 850 people have been killed since the 2nd of March and thousands displaced from their homes. There's no let-up yet in sight for the lives of so many caught in the crossfire of this war. Lauren Moss, BBC News.
Well, a drone strike has sparked a major fire near Dubai International Airport, forcing a temporary suspension of flights at one of the world's busiest aviation hubs. Our correspondent Azadeh Mashiri has more now from Dubai.
The fire has been contained and no injuries have been reported so far, but some airlines like Emirates have said that their flights have been cancelled altogether today, though there is a gradual resumption for some other flights. But this is only a day after the Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said that Iran was not targeting any civilian or residential infrastructure. And yet today, the UAE has had to respond to this drone-related incident at its international airport. A missile fell on top of a car, killing a civilian of Palestinian origin. And there's been another fire that's broken out at a major oil terminal in Fujairah. Again, they've said that they've contained that fire and that there have been no injuries. But this will infuriate leaders here who feel they've been pulled into this war unjustly and that there's no let-up in the amount of effort they have to do to keep protecting this image of safety and stability in a volatile region. So the last we've heard from the Ministry of Defense is that they are responding to these missile and drone threats from Iran, and there certainly isn't any let-up for the region here.
Well, Israel has said that it's begun limited and targeted land operations against the Iran-backed Hezbollah in Lebanon. Our Middle East correspondent Yolan Nel gave us this update from Jerusalem.
Well, the Israeli military announced this morning that it had already begun this expansion of its ground operations there, saying that it is targeting key Hezbollah strongholds in the south of Lebanon. There are three divisions that are already operating in the south of the country for the Israeli military. That would seem to be thousands of troops. We don't have any confirmation of exact numbers. And they're saying that two more divisions are going to be joining this operation in the coming days. Now, the Israeli military is calling this a defensive maneuver, saying that it's to protect Israeli civilians living in the north of the country. But of course, for the Lebanese, this is another blow to their sovereignty. It's a very worrying development.
And we're hearing also news of Israeli strikes.
And with that, we have now come to the conclusion after this episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Please do stay tuned for the Onkon Nanadengi program brought to you by Loise Shimi. And the Home Run Show with Dwight and Helmut kicks off at 16:30 with a business economic segment at 1800 hours with David Shombe. From Indafa, happy as usual. It is goodbye. I'll see you again tomorrow. Same time, same place.